It is 1:30, regardless of what the clock may show on our wall. This is the South Dakota Public Utility Commission meeting of Tuesday, November 1st, 2005, 1:30 p.m., State Capitol Building, Room 412, Pierce, South Dakota. My name is Gary Hansen. Today with me is Commissioner Bob Saar and Commissioner Dusty Johnson. We have a couple of items. Well, first of all, I better check to see who's on the phone with us. Jeff Larson, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Doug Idol and Larry Thompson?
Yes.
Tal Wieczorek?
I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Meredith Moore?
I'm here.
John Miller?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Jeff Decker?
Yes, and I have Clyde Gross with me as well.
Thank you. Mary Sysak?
Present.
You were just about to correct the pronunciation of your last name, weren't you? Melissa Thompson?
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Jim Atkins?
I'm here.
Lynn Rattenvale?
Yes, I'm here with David Lefuria.
Mary Lonis?
Here, Mr. Chairman.
Don Ball?
I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
And Linda Walsh? Is there anyone else? Linda, are you with us? Is there anyone else on the line with us? Before we get started today, there's a couple of announcements. Generally, we leave our announcements to the end. However, I would like to point out a few personnel changes that we have had and are in the process of having. First of all, we have a new emerging technology analyst, Mr. Phil Lusk, who is with us today. Phil, welcome. Look forward to, well, already he's shown his research capacity for providing a lot of information in a very short period of time. We appreciate that very much. Jason Schoenard is not with us right now, is he? Our new consumer protection specialist, Jason. And, of course, a very well-kept secret is that our executive director, Pam Bonrud, will be leaving, and she has accepted a position with Northwestern Energy Corporation as Director of Regulatory Affairs for South Dakota and Nebraska. No doubt moving up to a bigger and better things. And, Pam, we appreciate very much everything that you've done for us while you were here and for the consumers of South Dakota. We appreciate our relationship with you and hope that things go very smoothly in your new job with Northwestern just as soon as the purchase is completed with the municipalities. Comments made here are no reflection on the position of the PUC. However, we will announce that we do have an executive director's position opening, and we are looking forward to finding a new person. Yes, Bob Miller just raised his hand. Looking forward to interviews with and the changes that are ever taking place in our business. Administration. Approval of the minutes of the commission meeting held on September 27th, 2005 and October 4th. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move approval.
I would second the motion.
And I concur. Consumer reports. Status reports. From Deb Gregg.
Thank you. The commission has received a total of 1,471 consumer contacts during 2005. 165 of these contacts have been received since the last report was prepared for the October 4th, 2005 commission meeting. 39 of the contacts for this period involved telecommunication services. 26 of the contacts involved electrical services. 29 contacts involved natural gas services. And 32 contacts involved cellular phone service. There were 17 contacts that were related to the Do Not Call registry, and 22 contacts involved issues not regulated by the PUC. 1,196 of the 1,471 complaints received in 2005 have been resolved, and 2,126 of the 2,371 contacts received in 2004 have been resolved.
Thank you, Deb. And I ran into you at the downtown Holiday Inn.
Yes.
You were giving 2 days worth of...
Three.
3 days.
3 days.
And what were you doing down there?
I was with Rich Coit's group, and we were, I just basically went over what the PUC does, what the functions are, how complaints are handled when they come into the PUC, little things over the do not call registry, and little things on explaining your phone bill if you get questions.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Complaints. Item number one is CT05-003 in the matter of the complaint filed by Eldon Lindquist on behalf of Peer Radio Paging and Telephone Peer South Dakota against Quest Corporation regarding a billing dispute. The question before the commission is, today, shall the commission dismiss the complaint and close the docket? And that is being carried today by Deb.
I will take that one. Thank you, Commissioner Hansen. Jim Melhoff spoke with Mr. Lindquist, and he is satisfied with the settlement that he reached with Quest. And we've received a joint motion to dismiss that was signed by Mr. Lindquist's attorney and Quest's attorney. And since Mr. Lindquist is satisfied, and he also would like to have the complaint dismissed.
Thank you.
Okay.
Doubt that there's any further discussion. Commission.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we dismiss the complaint and close the docket.
Second.
I concur. Under electric, item number one is EL05-024 in the matter of the joint request for an electric service rights exception between Sioux Valley Southwestern Electric Cooperative, Inc., doing business as Sioux Valley Energy, and the City of Madison. Question before the commission is, shall the commission grant the joint request for an electric service rights? This is being brought to us by Bob.
Thank you, Chairman. This is Bob Knadel, commission staff. September 29, 2005, Sioux Valley Southwestern Electric Cooperative and the City of Madison filed for commission approval a joint request for electric service territory exception. The agreement between the city and Sioux Valley would permit the city to provide service to a new home for Paul and Laura Ursland in the southeast quarter of Section 31, Township 107 North, Range 52 West, in Sioux Valley service area. Paul and Laura Ursland have no objection to approval of the agreement. Sioux Valley has estimated that it would cost approximately $14,500 for the approximately 2,875-foot extension to serve the Ursland's. The city's existing facilities are approximately 50 feet from the Ursland's property. Staff believes that the service rights exception is in the public interest and recommends approval of the request.
Thank you, Bob. Are there any questions by the commission? Anyone else wishing to testify on this item? Commission action.
Mr. Chairman, I move the commission grant the joint request for an electric service rights exception.
Second.
I concur. Item number two, EL05-025, in the matter of the joint request for an electric service rights exception between Ottertail Power Company and Whetstone Valley Electric Cooperative. And staff analyst, Bob.
Thank you, Commissioner. On October 6, 2005, Whetstone Valley Electric Cooperative and Ottertail Power Company filed for commission approval a request for a service rights exception. The agreement between Whetstone and Ottertail would permit Whetstone to provide service to two rail switches for Western Consolidated Cooperative in the new grain handling operation in the southeast quarter, Section 7, Township 120 North, Range 49 West, and Ottertail's service area. Western Consolidated Cooperative has no objections to approval of the agreement. In order to serve this load, Ottertail would have to reduce the capacity of its 23 kV line to distribution voltage and would be required to cross under the Burlington Northern Railroad tracks. Staff believes that the service rights exception is in the public interest and recommends approval of the request.
Thank you, Bob. Are there any questions by the commission? Anyone else wishing to testify on this item? Commission action. I will move that the commission grant the joint request for an electric service rights exception.
Second.
And I concur.
Natural gas, NG05-011, in the matter of the filing by Northwestern Corporation doing business as Northwestern Energy for approval of a refund plan. Question before the commission is, today shall the commission approve the refund plan? And staff analyst, Dave Jacobs.
Yes, I believe Jeff Decker from Northwestern's on the line if he wants to say anything. Otherwise, I can go ahead.
Thank you, Dave. Jeff, do you have something you'd like to start out with?
I guess just in summary,
Northern Natural Gas was charging interim rates from November 03 through March of 05 approximately. And since the rates were, the rate case was settled, Northwestern received a refund of the difference between the interim rates and the settled rates, and we're proposing to pass that back to the utility customers through our true-up mechanism.
Thank you. Dave?
Thank you, Chairman. The refund was is proposed to be passed back to customers similar to the method that MDU recently used to pass back, and that is going through the PGA over the, in this case, over the next 12-month period is the way that Northwestern's PGA operates. Staff and the company did provide some supplemental information, I think you saw. If there's any questions regarding any of that supplemental information, I'd be happy to discuss that. Otherwise, staff would recommend approval of the refund plan with the provision that Northwestern pay interest on the refund balance allocated to Northwestern Energy from the date received by Northwestern from Northern Natural Gas, as described in that supplemental information. And it would make this approval effective today, November 1st, so they can plug it right into their November PGA.
Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to provide testimony on this item? Commissioners, questions?
Mr. Jacobson, either for you or for the petitioner, maybe you could describe in general terms how a utility company would have an overcollection like this.
Well, basically, Northern Natural Gas is the pipeline, interstate pipeline that transports gas into the Northwestern system. They file for rate increases before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. It generally takes a number of years for those cases. If they're fully litigated, it normally takes 3 to 5 years. And this, in the case of Northern Natural Gas, normally they're settled, but it still takes several years to go through that process. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission allows the interstate pipeline to put increased rates into effect subject to refund pending the outcome of those rate cases. When the case is either settled or fully litigated, then refunds are issued depending on the amount of overcharge because of those interim rates. And that's what happens in each of these cases.
Further questions? Is there a motion? I will move that the Commission approve the refund plan with the stipulations as stated by staff.
I will second.
I concur.
Telecommunications, TC04-213. In the matter of the filing by Brookings Municipal Utilities, doing business as Swift Telecommunications for designation as an ETC. Today, shall the Commission designate Brookings Municipal Utilities doing business as Swift Telecommunications as an eligible telecommunications carrier? Yes, Swiftel. Who is representing Swiftel? I have too many people on my list here.
You've got both David LaFuria and Lynn Ratnavel here on the phone, Chairman.
You are on first base, or you're in the batter's box, whichever you prefer, but go right ahead. Is there something that you'd like to communicate?
Really, Mr. Chairman, we got notice of the meeting very late in the process here, and really, having reviewed the record and looking at the commitments that Brookings has made, which are along the lines of the previously designated RCC order, in the absence of further objection, we would urge the Commission to designate Swiftel along the same lines as the RCC grant.
Thank you. Mr. Coit.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, commissioners, and staff. SDTA, and when I'm speaking on behalf of SDTA, I want to make it clear that I'm really representing the interest of the companies that are directly affected by the Brookings application, the landline telephone companies directly affected by that application, and the remainder of the SDTA membership, probably except for Brookings today. We have just a couple of concerns as an association. The first would be, I think we would like to see the decision in this matter at a later date after the proposed service area redefinition in the RCC case has actually been approved by the FCC. As you know, we as an association objected to the Commission's service area redefinition in the RCC case. It's my understanding that if the FCC does not act by November 14th and does not issue a written decision of some sort by the 14th, what you proposed in your service area redefinition is deemed approved under the FCC rules. So at this point, I guess just, you know, trying to make sure that there's some consistency. We would like to see this decision made after that occurs. At this point, I think it's probably likely that your decision will be deemed approved, but until the 14th, we will not know for sure. We also have some concerns with at least a few of the exchange areas that are covered by the Brookings application, where Brookings is actually seeking a partial a designation in only a part of the wire center or exchange area. The FCC has determined previously that it will not designate competitive ETCs below the wire center or exchange area. There are four exchanges that I'm aware of that all actually fall into the ITC territory as the rural LEC, and that would be Hendricks, Astoria, Elkton, and Gary. They are all noted as areas where Brookings is seeking partial designation. And the reason for that, and there's a good reason that they're seeking partial designation, but it doesn't change the fact that there's a little bit of a problem with those areas, is that there are portions of those exchanges that fall out of state. So you don't have jurisdiction as the commission to designate them out, you know, in areas that fall into Minnesota. That's why they've listed them as partial. That doesn't change the problem that we're faced with as an association. We do not believe that it's in the best interest to start down the path of designating competitive ETCs below the wire center. And in this case, you know, maybe it does not result in cream skimming, but if that precedent is one that is adopted by this commission and we have future ETC applicants, you could see a scenario where, you know, maybe the next applicant comes in and says, well, I'd really like to be designated below the wire center in just the town over here and not in the rural area that surrounds the town. That's, I think, the primary reason that the FCC has stuck to the wire center or exchange area and not designated below that. So there is some concern on our part about those areas. And it's not, in some cases, it may not be a big thing looking at the practical impact. For example, I just found out yesterday that with respect to Astoria, there is one customer in Minnesota. So the exchange boundary just barely touches Minnesota, but it does touch Minnesota, and there's one customer there. Now, what you do with that one, I'm not sure. But the other ones are not near that minuscule. But anyway, we are concerned about the designation below wire center. We want to make sure that whatever the commission does here is consistent with the redefinition that is ultimately addressed by the FCC.
Rich, does that not place them in a catch-22 position if they can't get the designation from South Dakota and then they go to the adjoining state? They have the same challenge there, that it's below the wire center because a portion of it's in South Dakota?
That's a good question. I think, though, that what my recollection is, Mr. LaFury is on the phone and he could correct me if I'm wrong. In the RCC case, there was a similar situation where there were some exchanges where you know, they fell into both jurisdictions. But I believe RCC already had designation over in Minnesota, so you went ahead and you designated them. But that was with the understanding that they already had designation over in Minnesota. Maybe one way of approaching this is to say, okay, we'll grant you designation in those areas on the condition that ultimately you'll get designation for the remainder of the exchange in Minnesota. I mean, that's a potential way of making sure that they're not going to just have designation in a part of the exchange. It does require them to take the next step if they want to serve those areas and get ETC support in those areas. Take the next step and apply over in Minnesota.
Exactly. Yeah. Appreciate your articulating that. But that was my second question, whether or not it would make sense to designate it in that fashion. Thank you. Are there further questions at this time by the commissioners?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, David LaFuria here. Could I have one response to those points that Mr. Coit made?
You certainly may, and we will give you an opportunity as we have discussion here from the other presenters, too, who may be testifying. But please go ahead.
Okay. On the first point, with respect to timing, while 14 or 13 days at this point does not seem like an extraordinarily long time to move forward, I would point out that should the FCC open a proceeding on November 14th and decide to figure out what to do next, in the past when they've done that, it's been a substantially long time for things to get resolved in the nature of 12 to 24 months. And there are substantial numbers of wire centers here which are not subject to redefinition. I think it's important for the Commission at the very least to get the designation done so that those wire centers can get going and Brookings can get to work building what it would build in those areas. Second of all, with respect to the partial wire center designation, number one, I think that the rural ILECs have some burden to come forward and at least make some demonstration of stream skimming in those areas. If it is a problem, I think they need to do more than just make a conclusory statement that this could be some issue. I think they need to have something in the record that says, here's exactly what the problem is, and we don't have that in the record yet. Also, Brookings is not carrier in Minnesota, you know, outside of the South Dakota area. So unlike RCC, who is already a carrier over there, Brookings does not have a license out in that part of the world to go to the Minnesota Commission and get designation. Finally, this case has come up in a number of situations. The FCC has addressed it in a Wyoming case in which they designated a carrier in a partial wire center. The FCC has also done this in Alabama and Mississippi, to my recollection. And a little more recently, the Colorado Commission designated a carrier. And the ALJ's order in the redefinition portion of this, it's really precisely the same situation you have here, where a carrier got designated for part of a wire center in Colorado, but the other part was over in the state of Nebraska, and the Colorado Telephone Association requested that the commission defer service area redefinition until such time as similar action was taken by the state of Nebraska. And the ALJ's finding, which was upheld by the commission, said, you know, there's no evidence that the Nebraska Commission is going to take this up in the foreseeable future. And even if it were poised to reconsider redefinition now, its decision would have no impact in Colorado because only this commission has jurisdiction to redefine the Colorado portion of the affected ILEC service area. In addition, waiting to redefine the Colorado portion of this service area until some unspecified and unknowable time in the future, contrary to the statute and the pro-competition and universal service direction the FCC and this commission has given us. All of these things, I think, militate in favor of the commission exercising its jurisdiction within the state and designating SWIFTEL throughout that area. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I have a question for Mr. Coit.
Go ahead.
I think you raised some good issues and good points. I'm just curious, from a procedural standpoint, how would you suggest that we go forward?
Well, as far as I would like, I guess in answering that question, I would like to respond to this comment that we should have to present some evidence that there is a cream skimming issue. I would disagree with that from a standpoint that, you know, the FCC, as far as I am aware of their decisions, and looking at Virginia Cellular in particular, which is certainly one of the, I guess, what you'd call the prominent decisions in the area. They basically decided that as a policy matter, we're not going to designate below the wire center. You followed that in the RCC case with your order. So I think that it is really a policy matter. I guess could you decide that, you know, you don't want to follow that policy and then start looking at the specific circumstances here? Yes. I mean, that's certainly your prerogative and within your discretion. But as of this point, there's a decision that you've made as a commission not to designate below the wire center. So we would rely on that. I don't think that commission action in this case on that issue, unless, Brookings wants to press the issue further, at least from our perspective, it's already decided. As far as the process, I really don't see an evidentiary process. We're making our points here based on what we see as the commission's direction in the RCC case, and we'd like to see them stay consistent with that. But an evidentiary hearing, I don't see a lot of value in that. Is that an answer?
Yes, thank you.
Other persons wishing to testify on this item? No? I misread your mind then.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Question. Mr. Quid, you talked about perhaps deferring this. Did you have an idea for how long?
Well, I just think that the FCC has to make a decision by the 14th. You have made a decision on how you're going to redefine the service area for RCC in that case. Nothing's come out from the FCC yet. That doesn't mean that something couldn't come out, but if something does come out, then you can readdress it at that point in time. If nothing comes out, you know as of November 14th that your service area redefinition in the RCC case has been accepted by the FCC. Why wouldn't you want to know that before you take action in this case? It seems to me that you'd want to be consistent in this case with what you did in the RCC case if you wish to grant designation. So why not make sure that the ducks are in a row and that decision is where it should be before you step in and make a decision here?
I'll put the question to Mr. LaFleurie in a slightly different way. Mr. LaFleurie, Commissioner Johnson, if the commission were to defer action on this item for, say, a month, and I understand your point about the FCC taking action sometime prior to November 14th that would stretch out a significant amount of time, but do you not think it would be in the public interest to delay this for a month until we knew what the FCC was doing?
I think no, for this reason. If you make the designation today, it's unlikely that the commission would, by November 14th, have prepared and actually filed with the FCC a petition for redefinition. And a decision today would permit WFTL to get started with the other areas where it has been designated, where redefinition is not an issue. Procedurally, the FCC on November 14th will only do one of two things. Either they will do nothing, which time the redefinition becomes effective, or they will issue a one-page public notice that says we're going to open a proceeding and look at this with the South Dakota Commission. And they've done that numerous times in the past, and to date, there's never really been a proceeding, so I honestly can't say what they would do. The only thing when they've opened a proceeding in the past that they did, you look back at the March 17th order from earlier this year, they resolved a whole bunch of them without actually doing a proceeding after they said that they were going to. And so I think fundamentally, if you act now, you get this started for the vast majority of these areas, and for the rest of them, if you hold off filing a petition for redefinition until November 14th, that's obviously fine and would serve, I think, their interest as well as ours.
Thank you.
Excuse me, go ahead.
I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, I have a question for Mr. LaFleurie.
Go ahead.
The you've made some changes to the original petition, is that correct?
Yes, over time in this file, several times.
And you added some exchanges?
I'm sorry?
Did you add some exchanges?
No, there were corrections made at the request of staff with respect to the designation of and identification of various wire centers that were inside and outside of the service area.
Okay, and I was just curious, did you were you able to give notification to people regarding those changes?
So I obviously would love to just flip that question off to our local council, who is not available right now, but I'm looking at, for example, I'm looking at some of our information submitted January 10th, and I see a service list on it attached. January 28th, a letter here, which also has a certificate of service on it. March 29th, a letter to Karen Kramer. A letter in response to her letter of February 16th. Gas power deposits are determined, and I see our local council signed it. I don't see a service list attached to this filing. I'm almost done. August 25, another letter from local council to Karen Kramer responding to questions she asked, and also from local council that page through. And again, these are my copies. They're not stamped receipt copies or anything, so I don't have everything. I don't have something that's official looking, but it's this letter of August 25 responding to Karen's questions. I don't see a service list or a CC list attached to that one. That's all I have.
Thank you.
I'd like to hear from staff at this time. Karen? Maybe I wouldn't like to hear from staff.
This is Rolaine Wiest. I'm acting as general counsel here. And just to go back to the last question, I would point out that they did actually add an exchange, as far as my notes can tell, West Marietta. Though they had served Farmers Mutual Telephone Company, they didn't actually say they were serving any of their exchanges until the revised filing. And I also, looking through the revised filing, I recognize staff did a very good job of correcting a number of errors and omissions, I would say, in their original filing. But I do actually have a few more questions that I think need to be answered before the commission makes its decision. And I'll just give you an example. I'm not going to go through all of them. For example, a Prairie Wave, I think they were moved from Exhibit C, which was immediate designation to Exhibit D. But going through the filing, I didn't find any cream skimming analysis for Prairie Wave. And so I'm not quite sure if Swiftel is actually seeking redefinition of Prairie Wave, if they're trying to serve all of Prairie Wave, because when you look at Prairie Wave, they don't have any actually listed as out. So if there's none out, are they serving all of them? I don't know. But they don't have Lennox on. I'm just not sure what's going on with that. But I have a number of questions along the same line. And going to Mr. Coit's position about waiting until the 14th, I also think, in addition to answering a number of questions that I have, that it would be beneficial to wait until the 14th. And if the FCC doesn't act, as Mr. Coit says, then I believe they go into effect. And I believe if they go into effect, then that actually has a bearing on some of the the companies that they're asking or didn't ask but should have asked for redefinition on. And so it would be much less confusing, I think, to wait until November 14th. And going to Mr. LaFleury's point about, well, if they do open a proceeding, that could last for a couple of years. I'm only making this recommendation to go to the 14th, only if they accept the redefinitions as we proposed in RCC. If they open up a new one, then I'm not at all suggesting that we wait a couple years to see how the FCC decides. And so I think if I could write down all of the issues that I still have and serve that on the company, that, and then we could handle it at the next commission meeting.
Thank you very much, Relaine. Karen, did you have anything at this time?
No, I think with what Ms. Weiss' recommendation of, or, you know, her questions, you know, I would get those answered, and then that next commission meeting is December 6th, so that would be plenty soon.
All right. Would we hear from Harlan then at all today or not? No? Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions by members of the commission? I'll make a motion to defer this item. I'm debating whether to a date certain, but I think I'll just simply defer it at this time and then allow the parties to establish a time for us.
Second.
I concur.
Second item is TC05-112 in the matter of the application of Navigator Telecommunications, LLC, for a certificate of authority to provide inter-exchange telecommunication services in South Dakota. Question before the commission is, today shall the commission grant a COA to Navigator Telecommunications? Staff, Bob.
Thank you, Chairman. Navigator Telecommunications, LLC, filed an application seeking a certificate of authority to provide inter-exchange services throughout South Dakota on a resale basis in accordance with the administrative rules of South Dakota. The applicant intends to offer MTS, travel services, and toll-free services to residential and business customers. The company has submitted revised pages to their proposed tariff to reflect staff-recommended changes and has agreed to restrictions from offering prepaid services and collecting deposits in advance payments. Staff recommends approval of the application with restrictions on offering prepaid services and collecting deposits in advance payments.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions by the commission? Commission action.
Mr. Chairman, I move the commission grant a COA to Navigator Telecommunications.
Second.
I concur. TC05-161 in the matter of the application of Mid-Continent Communications for approval to expand its certificate of authority to provide local exchange service in the Woolsey Exchange of the service territory of Santel Communications Cooperative. Question before the commission is, shall a commission grant intervention to Santel Communications Cooperative, Inc.? Staff analyst.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, this is Jeff Larson for Santel. Would it be appropriate for me to speak?
Go right ahead.
Thank you. This is just an oversight or mistake on my part, believing that we were a party. We did not seek an intervention earlier when you had set an informal timeline. We seek that now, as SDTA did last time, for the obvious reason that we're the local exchange carrier involved in the request from Mid-Continent, and don't think there would be any harm to anyone that the intervention be granted at this time, and would hope that the commission could do that.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Gerdes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, my name is Dave Gerdes. I'm a lawyer from Peer, and I represent Mid-Continent Communications. And in the spirit of cooperation and also recognizing the handwriting on the wall, we have no objection to this intervention.
Are there any other interested parties wishing to testify on this item? If not, is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we grant intervention to Santel Communications Cooperative, Inc.
I will second.
And in the spirit of cooperation, I will concur.
Item number four, in the matter of the approval of agreements in dockets TC05-170, TC05-171, and 172, and 176, and 179. Question before the commission is, shall the commission approve the agreements? And this is being handled by Ms. Kramer.
Thank you. The agreements were properly filed. Staff found no discriminatory language and no comments were filed. Therefore, staff would recommend approval of the agreements.
Thank you. Are there any questions by commissioners? Is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move we approve the agreements.
I second.
And I concur. Item number 5, in the matter of the filing of approval of amendments to agreements and dockets TC-05-174 and TC-05-178. The question before the Commission is, shall the Commission approve the amendments to the agreements? Again, Karen?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendments were properly filed. Staff found no discriminatory language and no comments were filed. Therefore, staff would recommend approval of the amendments to the agreements.
Questions by the commissioners and motion? I will move that the commission approve the amendments to the agreements.
I second.
And I concur.
TC-05-173 in the matter of the petition of Fiber Ring Revenue Pooling Association for approval of amended revenue pooling arrangement documents. Question before the commission is, shall the commission approve the amended revenue pooling arrangement documents? And who's first up on this one? Oh, Darla.
Good afternoon. My name is Darla Pullman Rogers, and I am the attorney for FERPA, which is the Fiber Ring Revenue Pooling Association. FERPA has a petition pending in front of this commission asking for approval of its pooling arrangements, of the pooling arrangements between FERPA and the Ring User Lex, and also the arrangements between FERPA and the Sonnet Ring providers. And it's as these arrangements are contained in contracts filed as a part of this petition. We are further asking you to find that the FERPA pooling arrangements are in the public interest. If the commission would permit, I would like to give you just a little bit of a background with regard to FERPA, and hopefully that will help you in your decision today. FERPA was organized on March 17 of 1999 to provide a pooling mechanism for a collective, cost-shared, cost-averaged, non-distance-sensitive, fully protected transport network for local exchange companies whose traffic is carried on any of the joint South Dakota local exchange companies and SDN Sonnet Ring transport facilities. This pooling arrangement is consistent with South Dakota statutes that clearly articulate the intent of the South Dakota legislature to enable companies in South Dakota to provide infrastructure such as the Sonnet interconnection survivable rings, which are the subject of this petition. I have cited some of those statutes for you in our petition, but I would in particular like to draw your attention to SDCL 49.1. It is the intent of the legislature to encourage telecommunications companies to more efficiently meet the infrastructure deployment goal described in SDCL 49, 3160, and 61 for a fully integrated Sonnet backbone of interconnected survivable rings. To that end, telecommunications companies may jointly provide facilities and enter into revenue pooling arrangements between and among themselves relating to the provisioning of these facilities. And, of course, that is exactly the purpose of FERPA. So, historically, then, what was FERPA's function? It had basically a threefold function. Number one, FERPA was formed to establish a joint provisioning arrangement. Number two, FERPA coordinated the actual construction of the rings. And third, FERPA provided a centralized administration system of the ring facilities. With FERPA providing those functions, the independent LEX in South Dakota, together with SDN, were able to construct, implement, provision, and maintain a fully integrated Sonnet backbone of interconnected survivable rings. These rings today serve nearly all of the independent LEX in the state, and they cover more than 70% of the geography of South Dakota. These rings also allow the LEX to provide the advanced services expected and articulated in the South Dakota statutes. And the question then is, how was this accomplished? And specifically, it was accomplished through a series of contractual arrangements. FERPA does not own any of the facilities. It's the pooling FERPA is the pooling mechanism that administers the system of the ring facilities. SDN and some of the LECs actually own the facilities. They own portions of the ring. And then those facilities are provisioned or provided through contractual agreements between the companies or SDN, depending on who owns that portion of the ring. The contracts are between the local exchange carrier and FERPA or SDN and FERPA. Those are called the Sonnet Ring Provider Agreements, the SRPs, and copies of those have been filed with the petition. Then SDN and the LECs that use the ring facilities also enter into a ring user local exchange company agreement with FERPA, and these are called the RULs. So the concept and function of FERPA is the same today as when it was first formed. This commission reviewed the FERPA organization and the association in the year 2000, and in fact, by order dated July 20th of 2000, approved the whole concept of FERPA and the way it functions. We're asking you to do the same today. The contracts that were part of the initial filing expire on December 31st of 2005. So new contracts have now been negotiated among the various parties, FERPA and the LECs and FERPA and SDN, and those agreements or the new contracts will be effective January 1 of 2006. The arrangements are similar. Some of the terms of the contracts have been changed a little bit, and the expiration dates, that type of thing. So the purpose of the petition and the reason we're here today is to amend and update the original FERPA filing and to seek your approval of the amended SRP and RUL agreements and the other revised documents. And we're further asking this commission to find that FERPA's pooling arrangements are in the public interest. I have with me today the president of FERPA and in person, he's here in person, Rod Bauer, and also I believe on the phone are our consultants, Vantage Point, and so we would be available for any questions, and we would ask your favorable consideration of our petition. Thank you.
Thank you, Darla. Are there any questions of Ms. Rogers?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In paragraph 13 of your petition, I mean, you explain that, you know, cost studies don't really have anything to do with that, and the real, you know, meat and potatoes of the numbers come in with individual when LECs file their switched access cost studies with this commission. But still, and it may be the fact that I haven't gone through this before, so my apologies if you've sown this ground many times in the past, but it seems as though, you know, in some of these contracts there are significant increases, and there don't appear to be any basis for those increases. Can you help shed some light on me as to why there'd be those significant increases?
Yes, I believe we can. I'm going to ask if Larry Thompson is on the phone and if he would like to respond to that question.
Yes, I'm on the phone. Are you referring to the PNS rate as far as increases go? Because those have been coming down with time. Can you quantify what increases you're referring to?
Yeah, and some of the contracts, I was looking at the 128 pages of the exhibits. It seems as though some of the contracts were increases over the past. Did I misread that?
We have one increase, one large increase in the FERPA PNS rates. And the PNS rates, again, are the rates that the LECs, the ring user LECs, like Darla mentioned, who use the network for putting on their switch traffic onto the network. And that was a planned increase when we formed FERPA, when we had a fairly significant upgrade when we were 2 years into the process. We saw the rates go up at that time. They've progressively been going down since then. There are a few other internet rates and a few other things that have seen some increases with time. And that's what you're referring to. And we're just bringing those with the industry.
And I guess maybe some of my concern, you know, comes from the there doesn't appear to be a lot of information about that. And we can ask about particular pages, and I can ask about particular exhibits. But would it be unusual for the commission to get more information on some of these contracts, or is that, you know, not appropriate? Again, I ask a lot of these questions because I haven't been through this process before.
Darla, do you want to answer that? I can kind of explain to you the concept of how FERPA comes up with its rates.
I was just going to suggest, would that be helpful just in general?
Is there transparency for, I mean, the users, I assume, I mean, obviously people who aren't members of this group, you know, obviously have to pay, you know, to use some of these facilities. Do they have transparency? Do they know where these costs come from?
I think that our, if we could just generally explain how FERPA arrives at its rates, and Larry, you can certainly step in here. Our rates are probably not, I wouldn't say they are as formal as a cost study, but they are based on our cost. And, you know, we separate out the non-regulated portion of the cost and ultimately arrive at the cost. There is also some negotiation because you have ring users and you have ring providers, and so there's some negotiation between those groups and including SDN. So it doesn't, you know, the cost study methodology doesn't really fit this particular association's function, but it is a rate that is based on costs and then negotiated out further between and among the parties that are involved.
Yeah, and let me just add one thing to that. The way FERPA pays the entities that provide fiber facilities, and they pay the entities that provide the electronics, that make this whole joint venture possible. And one thing I do want to mention with regard to that is, you know, Vantage Point works in a lot of states. This level of cooperation among the LECs is just almost unheard of, and because of that cooperation, they've been able to provision these survivable rings across the state so much less expensively than any of the alternatives. But that's where FERPA spent this money. It receives payments from the LECs for putting their circuits then on the network. And like Darla said, is we take the regulated portion of that investment. There are some unregulated functions that get pulled out of the expenses. What's left over then is we take the circuits, and FERPA, you know, is the net some zero kind of entity. So what we bring in, we pay out. And so we determine what the circuit basis, what the circuit cost should be based on, you know, what the revenue FERPA needs to be able to operate. There's several traffic classes, and each one of those are listed in there. Public network switch traffic, PNS, which is what the circuit switching class is. There's also classes for internet and E911 and some other public interest categories that FERPA supports as well.
Is it unusual? I mean, the commission's in the position of, you know, approving these arrangements without necessarily knowing where the numbers come from. And I mean, is that typical? Is that unusual that we would approve agreements that we don't really know how those numbers were put together?
Well, I do not think it's unusual since it's been done here by this commission as recently as 2000. I think part of it, again, is you know, the statutory enabling legislation that really does encourage these types of arrangements. If the rates became subject to question or unduly burdensome for either the RULs or the SRPs, obviously the negotiations would fall down and we wouldn't be here. And in addition, you know, those rates are part of and included within the cost studies that the staff examines when we file our cost studies in each docket. So if this system really started to deteriorate and fall apart, there would be, I think, other areas in which you could examine the rates, but again, probably we wouldn't be here if there was a discrepancy in the rates or they couldn't be negotiated and agreed upon between the users and the providers.
Well, that is insightful, and I appreciate that. And certainly my questions, I mean, I wouldn't want to leave the idea that I don't think FERPA is wonderful. I mean, obviously this is a real example of cooperation. And I would just ask, when we get to staff's opportunity to make a recommendation, if they could just sort of provide their perspective on some of the questions I've asked. Thank you.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman,
Just a point of clarification. You haven't had anyone ever challenge the costs or the rates coming through on this since its inception, have you?
Not to my knowledge. I've not. I know of no challenges, no.
Thank you.
John Smith, did you have a question?
I did. Darla, would the numbers that form the base, the cost numbers that form the basis of these contracted numbers, are those numbers subject to revelation through discovery in the cost study dockets if the parties thereto feel it necessary to look beneath the contract numbers themselves?
I would not know of a reason why they would not be subject to discovery or questions, but, you know, data requests from staff.
So there is a forum. I mean, ultimately, one of the cost payers here, right, ends up being, does that not end up being switched access customers? So they have an avenue, if they want to look beneath the end result numbers contained in these contracts and see what makes up those numbers?
I believe that would be a fair statement, yes.
Okay. I'm just asking you this because I'm not an expert on it. I notice in the statute, and one of the concerns that appears for the legislature, and I'm sure for you and probably for SDT and others, is the antitrust exemption provisions. And is it your view that we meet the minimum standards necessary for antitrust exemption in the absence of making some cost inquiry in this case? I'm not presuming that the answer. I'm just asking you.
I believe your question to me is, if the commission approves our petition today as presented without conducting a further inquiry into cost, would that grant us the antitrust protection of state action?
Right. Are we risking risking weakening or losing possibly the protection from the antitrust of the antitrust exemption by not doing that? I'm not suggesting that we are. I'm just asking you whether or not that's a risk.
Interestingly enough, FERPA did form a task force to review and explore some of those issues, and the recommendation of the task force was, you know, to go forward with this filing. So I think that their consensus in looking at that issue was that it's not a risk, more of a risk for us to seek this approval.
And would one of the reasons for that maybe be that you each operate within unique certificated territories and are not, in fact, anyway operating in a competitive environment for these services?
That certainly could have been one of the considerations of the task force, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Darla. Does staff have Marlon?
Thank you, Chairman. This is Harlan Best, Commission staff. I have reviewed the information that was submitted by the company and have discussed with Mr. Thompson the method or the way in which the rates were arrived at, i.e. through negotiation and assigned contract. And staff would recommend that the Commission grant the filing of the petition with the attached replacement exhibits, I guess is what you'd call it, not approving the ones that have already been approved, but the revised exhibits.
Thank you. Are there any questions by members of the commission? Is there anyone else wishing to be heard before the commission on this matter? Is there a motion? Go ahead. I will make the motion that the commission approve the amended revenue pooling arrangement documents.
I will second.
I concur.
Item number 7, in the matter of the filing for approval of terms and conditions for interconnection, unbundled network elements, ancillary services, and resale of telecommunication services in dockets TC05-175 and TC05-177. Question before the commission is, shall the commission approve the agreements? Karen.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer of staff. The amendments were properly filed. There was no discriminatory language found. There were no comments filed, and therefore staff would recommend approval of the agreements.
Questions? Action?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the commission approve the agreements.
And I second.
I concur. Item number 8, in the matter of the failure of certain telecommunications companies to timely file a gross receipts tax. Question before the commission is, today shall the commission issue an order to show cause as to why the commission should not fine or suspend or revoke the certificates of authority of each of these companies for failure to pay the requisite gross receipts tax. Heather Forney.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, you have before you a list of the companies that have either not filed their report showing us what their revenue earnings were, or they have filed that report but failed to pay the gross receipts tax assessment on that. And I have them broken down by type of company and also what they failed to file. So you'll see that first list, these are wireless companies that have not filed. And by that I mean they haven't told us what their revenue stream was for fiscal year or for calendar year ended December 31st, 2004. Of these three companies, wireless companies don't have certificates of authority, so we can't revoke a certificate from them like we can other companies, and that's kind of the, I don't know if you'd call it the stick that we use, but that's just basically for your information, that those are wireless companies that haven't filed anything, but that we can't revoke their certificate because they don't have one. The next list, those are local exchange providers that haven't filed. Followed by operator service providers that have filed but not paid. This Tinetics Telecommunication Services, Inc., which is listed, I have received their check as of October 27, 2005, so I would ask that you remove them from consideration.
That company again?
Tinetics Telecommunication Services, Inc. They're that operator service provider, the OSP. Under the long-distance providers that have not filed or paid, these are companies that haven't filed their revenues, nor have they paid any gross receipts tax. The one that I would like to bring to your attention there is Univance Telecommunications, Inc. It's come to my attention that this company is now in bankruptcy, and so we will not go after them for an order to show cause. And then finally, we have the long-distance providers that have filed. So I do have their reports in hand, and I know what they owe us, but they haven't paid their gross receipts tax. And for your information, I would say 99% of them are in that $250 minimum range. And I would just at this point ask that we issue orders to show cause to each of these companies for their failure to file.
Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I may please. With the wireless companies, are they all at the $250 range as well?
There is no minimum for the wireless
companies.
No
minimum for them. Are they licensed to do business in the state of South Dakota through the Secretary of State's office, do you know?
I haven't checked, but I can.
Okay. Maybe you could check on that. I'm just curious. I realize that there may be some problems with us taking action or revoking because they have no COA, but I'm just curious if they're in violation of state law, if that's something that might have bearing on their status as a corporation or whatever entity they are doing business in South Dakota.
I'd be happy to check on
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd like to get a feel for a little bit of historical perspective. How does the size of this list compare to the list in past years? And then also, if you can give me an idea, I mean, let's say last year, we had 35 companies on there. Give me the breakdown of what generally happens. I mean, did we revoke two-thirds of the COAs? Did a third of them step forward and pay their debt to society? What happened here?
I would say the list this year is pretty comparable, maybe a little smaller than we've seen in the past. And I think that might have something to do with the way that things are done now. The deadlines are a little different than they have been. We're sending more second and third notices. In years past, the day this list came out, I received three phone calls. So, and I've already received payment from one of them. So that gives you a little bit of an idea. I would say probably two-thirds of these companies actually will end up with their certificates revoked.
So am I led to believe, then, that there's not a lot of repeat offenders in any given year because a lot of them are just – they're not doing business the next year when this list comes out.
Right. And I've actually – some of these companies have called. They've said that they want to they don't have any customers in the state. They don't want to do business here. They don't want to pay the $250 minimum, and so they just prefer that we revoke their certificate.
saves them $250.
Are there companies that have appeared on this list 2 or 3 or 4 years in a row? Or?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And if I may add, I know from my recollection of the past few years is that typically, and this year I don't see it, typically there will be one or two recognizable names who just inadvertently failed to file. So hopefully it sounds like they immediately do file. So hopefully it sounds like the process is working a little bit better on making sure that we get notification and that those companies respond and get their payments made without having to be put on the bad list.
I believe it does, yes.
Thank you. And thanks for your efforts on that.
Further questions? Anyone else wishing to testify on this item before the commission? If not, is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, one quick clarifying question. Do you want the order to show cause on the wireless companies as well?
I was thinking we might just make the motion to issue orders and take such actions as recommended by staff. That way it would take care of the items as it was recommended.
And you can still fine them. I mean, that's in the question. Fine, revoke, or suspend.
Yeah, and we also have two that we need to take off before we do anything.
Correct, and that's part of the recommendation. She recommended that, so if we just make it take such actions as recommended by staff in her testimony, if you're comfortable with that.
That's fine if you want to make the motion.
I will make the motion that the commission issue orders and take such actions with each provider as recommended by staff.
Second.
And I concur.
The next item is going to be transcribed. It's on electricity. It's EL04-016. We've been here for a little over an hour. Are you all right to continue? All right. In the matter of the filing by Superior Renewable Energy, LLC, et al., against Montana Dakota Utilities Company regarding the Java Wind Project. The question before the commission is, shall the commission grant the motion for reconsideration, and shall the commission issue an order finding that MDU has an existing obligation and or contract pending approval under PURPA and thus is subject to PURPA's mandatory purchase obligations, and shall the commission issue an order to show cause to MDU? Do we have persons representing Superior? I believe Linda Walsh. Are you on the phone?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
And is there anyone else with you?
No. Mr. Meyer-Henry, I believe, was going to call in, but I'm not sure if he has.
Thank you. When you're pressing your button and speaking, we're hearing you loud and clear, although there's a little bit of noise associated with that. You might turn down the volume just a smidgen, if you would. Mr. Meyer-Henry, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Welcome. The just want to make sure, is there anyone else that Mr. Gertis is here? And we will begin with the motion is on October 12, 2005, MDU filed a reply to the Superior motion for reconsideration. And so we will first hear from Superior. Linda or Mark?
I think I'll be responding. I guess first I would like to address the issue of why this motion is not moot. That was something that MDU provided in their pleading, an explanation of why this motion is now moot, because they are not going to refile their petition at FERC for termination of the mandatory purchase obligation. Well, we don't think the motion for reconsideration is moot because, as you can see in the pleading, MDU is committing not to file at the present time any motion or any petition at FERC, which Superior thinks keeps the door open for them to file at any point, and really giving them the ability to pull the rug out from under this proceeding at any point in time. So we believe that the motion is still alive. It's not mooted by MDU's agreement to go forward with the hearing. So we would ask that the commission rule on the motion. Regarding the merits of the motion itself, regarding the commission's legal authority to rule on the existing obligation question, I think you can look at it sort of in a simple way. Yeah, on the one hand, you have MDU arguing that the Northwestern Public Service case supports MDU's argument that the state legislature has not granted specific authority for the commission to adjudicate this matter or to rule on this matter in any way. On the other hand, you have just a whole array of support for the contrary position. First of all, there's no express prohibition in the state that the state legislature has expressed for the commission's authority. The Northwest Public Service case dealt with contract interpretation and did not expressly prohibit the commission from ruling in this type of a proceeding regarding PURPA implementation. If you take PURPA itself, that supports or that requires state implementation of the PURPA regulations, the commission's order in F3365 carried that out, where the commission stated it would resolve disputes that arise regarding PURPA implementation. FERC's Order 69 specifically says that FERC has the authority to enforce the state regulatory authorities, not only the compliance with the implementation of the PURPA rules, but also the enforcement of those rules on a case-by-case basis. And then, of course, we have FERC v. Mississippi, where the state, the Supreme Court of the United States upheld the PURPA implementation regime and found that it did not violate the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. So I think if you weigh all of this, you have to conclude that the commission has the authority to rule on the motion. And arguably, the state commission, you all have already ruled, in a sense, on this motion regarding existing obligation simply by setting this proceeding for hearing. This matter came before the commission more than a year ago. It was set for hearing, and it has been going through the process rather slowly, but going through on the assumption that there is a PURPA obligation here. Why else would we all be here? If someone had come in to try to enforce a PURPA obligation and they didn't meet the requirements of PURPA, the case never would have been set for hearing. It would have been summarily dismissed. Regarding how we proceed, a couple things. The Superior's motion for reconsideration has essentially two aspects to it, or three aspects, I should say. Number one, to reconsider the order deferring the hearing and to go ahead and setting a hearing date for this proceeding. Number two, ruling on the question of the existing obligation question. And the third thing would be issuing an order to show cause that NDU is in violation of PURPA. With the last item, the order to show cause item, NDU and also the commission staff tend to view that as a question of enforcement of PURPA that goes beyond the state authority. And you know, I'd like to explain how I view this in a different way. The commission, of course, has the authority to to ensure that matters that come before it proceed in an efficient and timely manner. And I don't think anyone would argue with the Commission's ability to order participants in a hearing to follow the rules, follow deadlines, that sort of thing. I think if you look at it this way, that the order to show cause is really just a message to MDU that this proceeding needs to go forward and that delays won't further delays be tolerated. Regarding the hearing date, I believe there's an open date, December 12 through 16. Superior would like to have those dates set for the hearing if they're still available. Also, Superior would like to have the opportunity for both parties, of course, to file supplemental testimony in this case, and Superior would request the opportunity to file rebuttal testimony. I think that we could probably work out some dates with MDU that are mutually agreeable for that. We do not believe that additional discovery is appropriate here because that would cause further delay in the proceeding. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Walsh. Are there any questions by commissioners at this time? Mr. Curtis. Excuse me, Mr. Meyer Henry, did you have anything first?
Oh, I did not.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Curtis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, my name is Dave Curtis. I'm a lawyer from Pierre, and I represent Montana Dakota Utilities Company in this matter. I think the first thing that we have to keep in mind here is that the first question posed on the agenda is, shall the commission grant the motion for reconsideration, or grant the motion for reconsideration? I would submit that that is that question, and that the motion for reconsideration itself is moot because the commission's order deferred this matter until after PURPA had acted on the Alliant petition. PURPA has acted on the Alliant petition, and they dismissed it. In addition to that, PURPA has acted on MDU's petition for a termination of the mandatory purchase obligation and dismissed that as well. So procedurally, before this commission, the motion to grant them reconsider is out of order and is mooted because of the act of FERC. That is the condition stated by this commission has been met, and therefore by the very terms of the order, it's no longer in effect. Secondly, as it relates to this commission entering an order to find that MDU has an existing obligation, we would again submit that this issue is moot at the present time, and it's for a very simple reason. Montana, Dakota does not have a petition pending before FERC to terminate the mandatory purchase obligation. This entire issue only arose after August 5th when the Energy Policy Act of 2005 was adopted. And so when that happened, that's the first time anybody ever thought about whether or not there was, and I'm using the legislative language here, any contract or obligation was in effect or pending approval at the time this act was adopted. Well, that's when it first came up. So to argue that by becoming a QF back in April and by this commission setting a hearing in this matter, the commission had somehow decided that question, you simply can't say that because the act was not passed until August 5th. And so what we're talking about here is something in context with the passage of the Energy Policy Act itself. And the only reason we are here is as it relates to the question of whether or not the mandatory purchase, the termination of the mandatory purchase obligation is effective in this matter. That is mooted simply because, number one, MDU does not have a petition pending and says it won't file one, and we won't, and we want to go ahead with this hearing. Now, I'll say it however you want. We're not laying in wait for Superior to jump out from behind a tree at them in December. We do intend to go ahead with this hearing, and I can tell you that we won't file a petition as it relates to Superior until after a hearing is held in this matter. That's not the point. The point is we do not want to set other precedents which might occur in other cases that may have application to other QFs. As I told counsel for staff earlier when we were talking about this, it's a very fundamental proposition of the practice of law that you don't stipulate yourself out of a case that doesn't yet exist. And that's the point here. The point is that there is no reason that the commission should decide whether or not there is an obligation because the question isn't before the commission. Then to take the other point, I respectfully disagree with Ms. Walsh in her reading of FERC versus Mississippi, and we quoted that in one of the, I think, four filings we made with the commission on this subject, the one that's dated October 12th, where, if I may read just briefly, the Supreme Court said Titles 1 and 3 of PURPA require only consideration of federal standards. And if a state has no public utilization, if a state has no public utilities commission or simply stops regulating the field, or I might add, or if they never regulated it in the first place, it need not even entertain federal proposals. Clearly, what the Supreme Court has said in this decision is that there is no supervisory capacity that FERC has over this commission. It can't tell this commission what to do because of the 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution. They can't tell you what to do. You can voluntarily agree to participate in federal actions, but you cannot be told to do something that the state has decided not to do, and it's our position that the state has decided not to do this simply by not authorizing this commission to implement PURPA, especially the 05 Act. And so we submit that the commission is without jurisdiction to do so, and we cited, I think, six cases from three different states in this area, two from North Dakota, two from South Dakota, and two from Minnesota, that say that if the commission does not specifically authorize this commission to act, it has no jurisdiction or statutory authority to act. And we would submit that that is good law, our friends from Superior have not shown us any concrete authority to the contrary, and that is simply that if the legislature has not authorized this commission to act in a specific way, then it can't do so. And we have the best example in the world. I don't remember exactly what year it was now. It's in one of these briefs that I wrote. But I think it was in like 98 or 99, this commission went to the legislature and specifically asked the legislature to give it the authority to implement the 1996 Telecommunications Act. And if you go to the telecommunications statutes that define the jurisdiction of this commission, they very specifically talk about how this commission is empowered to implement the act. And I would submit to you, members of the commission, that that's the point we're talking about. Now, it can very easily be remedied. All you have to do is go to the legislature in about 2 months and say, we need a statute that says we can implement PURPA. But right now, you don't have that jurisdiction, I would submit, based upon very clear authority from the South Dakota Supreme Court. And so, really, there are at least three reasons why this motion that the commission issue an order finding that MDU has an existing obligation is not well taken. Number one, it's mooted. But even secondly, if it were not mooted, we would submit that the commission does not have the jurisdiction to entertain the question. We think these are substantial rights that the commission should not should not ignore. Finally, as far as the point on the hearing itself, Montana, Dakota will cooperate with the commission with Superior. I should tell you that the people from Montana, Dakota, and the people from Superior are negotiating even as we sit here trying to get this thing settled so that we don't have to go to a hearing. But I don't disagree that we have to set a hearing date. If it's going to be the 12th and 16th, I seem to remember having seen some emails from some of the parties to this proceeding that said that we probably need to update figures and that we probably need some discovery, and we certainly need to update the testimony. Now, I will leave it to this commission to decide whether or not the 12th to the 16th is a proper time to do it. I can't make that decision today. It seems to me that what the commission ought to do is have Mr. Smith consult with the parties and come up with what is appropriate. And if the 12th through the 16th of December fits, that's fine. But I think we ought to take some time to make sure that the case can be properly prepared for the commission so that the commission can act, and hopefully we'll get the thing settled beforehand. Thank you very much.
Thank you. John, did you have a question?
I do have some questions. First, with respect to the FERC versus Mississippi language, I just want to get your take on this. Both of those, or the language you quoted, by my reckoning, is found in the overall subdivision Roman numeral 4 of the decision entitled the 10th Amendment. The first section of that particular subdivision of the opinion deals with Section 210, which is the avoided cost rights proceedings, the purchase obligation rights proceedings before state commissions that were mandated by PURPA. The second of that deals with the mandatory consideration of standards, which dealt with things like declining rates, and so on and so on. If I read this case right, the provisions that you quoted related to that second category of thing, which dealt with mandating substantive standards to states, and the Supreme Court seemed much more concerned and hesitant in that area than they did in with respect to adjudications under Section 210. Whereas I read this decision, the Supreme Court did not hesitate at all to say that the Mississippi Commission was instructed and by law directed by Congress to do these, perform these adjudications, and that the absence of a particular enabling statute in Mississippi, that and not an excuse for the Commission to decline to hear. And could you please maybe give me your take on the way I read this.
And I
looked up those Mississippi statutes, by the way. Yeah. None of those statutes reference adjudications under PURPA. Only two of them even reference electric. They're both certificate of convenience and necessity statutes. The other two statutes involve telecommunications.
But to answer your question, Mr. Smith, I'm familiar with what you're talking about, and it seemed to me that in reading this that they were setting out a broad standard against which these things are judged. And we're talking here about a third thing, and that is the Energy Policy Act of 2005. And that's not the same context that the Supreme Court was talking about in the FERC versus Mississippi case, I don't believe, because here we have yet a third context for this, and that is who adjudicates, who decides what is a contractor obligation in effect or pending approval. And it seems to me that that falls more closely under the language that I've been talking about, and not under the secondary standards discussion in the case that you're talking about. And we can maybe disagree, but that's my take on it, and that is simply that we're talking about an entirely different thing here than the standards thing that was talked about in the second section of the FERC versus Mississippi.
In your view, is there a question of fact currently at issue regarding the issue of whether there's a current obligation, or is that a pure issue of law?
I think it's both, both a question of fact and a question of law.
And could you identify for the commission what the issue of fact would be?
Well, the issue of fact would be if, in fact, depending on what we mean by an obligation, do we mean obligation in the traditional sense of a contract? Does it have to have terms? Does it have to have a price? Does it have to have a time frame? Does it have to talk about delivery terms? Does it have to talk about who's going to transmit power or not? Because none of those things are decided, and if you view the term obligation in its traditional legal context, it seems to me that there's no obligation because none of the details of the obligation has been established yet, and so that's a question of fact as well as a question of law.
If we, assuming without deciding, obviously I don't decide anything here, but just assuming for the purpose of argument that the term obligation in that statute could be construed to mean an obligation to purchase under PURPA pending before a state commission, assuming that. If that is the issue here, then is there an issue of fact?
Well, yes, because my understanding of PURPA is that the obligation to purchase is depending upon the ability of the parties to get together on the terms and conditions of the purchase. That's what the whole avoided cost proceeding is about. And if they can't get together, if one of them is totally unreasonable, if they can't get together, then they won't have a contract.
But isn't it true, isn't the entire purpose of a PURPA adjudication under Section 210 and the only reason why it would ever be pending before a state commission to resolve those issues when they cannot be resolved voluntarily, as was specifically envisioned by the commission's order back in 1981?
Well, the commission's 1981 order said that we're not going to order anybody to do anything. We're going to act as a mediator. Try to solve disputes between the parties. That's the way I read it. I quoted some of that language. Excuse me.
Exclusive of the Energy Policy Act of 2005, does this commission have the ability to determine whether there's an obligation existing under PURPA as it pertains to the current proceeding we're looking at here? In other words, I'm going to Ms. Walsh's point about... if there is no obligation under PURPA, what are we doing here? And when shouldn't we be looking at a motion to dismiss and stop wasting our time?
If there is an obligation under PURPA, what are we doing here?
There is not an obligation under PURPA.
Well, the obligation under PURPA before the 05 Energy Act, I believe, was for a utility to purchase from a QF at avoided costs, and then the parties were supposed to get together and decide what those avoided costs are, and if they can't get together on the avoided costs, then it's up to the commission to determine what those avoided costs are.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you. Are there any questions by the commissioners at this time? If not, staff, Karen?
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. Ms. Greff was originally going to argue this matter, and so my knowledge of it runs very brief, very thin, we should say. Therefore, I would rely on the brief that she has filed as to the motion to reconsider. That motion, you know, if you're looking at it purely in terms of procedurally, yes, it's certainly properly in front of the commission. However, a ruling on it is not necessary, as Mr. Gerdes pointed out, that FERC has made its determination. This matter is set to go to hearing. I believe the dates are December 13 through 16 are the dates we're looking at. Whether there is an obligation, an existing obligation, staff believes that there is an existing obligation. However, the commission, should it wish to, can withhold judgment on that until it's the hearing, and make its determination at that point. As to the order to show cause, staff would recommend that the commission deny that. I believe that staff can work with the parties to work on dates for pre-filed testimony, updating that. The last I recall on that, Mr. Gerdes, is we were kind of waiting for MDU to see if MDU wanted to file updated testimony. Superior had replied that they wanted to file updated testimony, but not discovery. They thought that was that would probably extend it too long, and so we were just kind of waiting to hear if you guys wanted to also file some updated testimony.
Yes.
Okay, so
I thought I had communicated that, but if I hadn't,
our email system hasn't been working the best this week, so it may you may have sent it and I may not have gotten it.
My scheduling system of my work at my office hasn't been working.
Okay. So that being the case, I think we can get some dates worked out and some time frames to get testimony filed.
Mr. Chairman, if I could ask a clarification question.
Please go ahead.
If the December dates that were discussed, I mean, is gathering additional testimony, would that affect potential dates at all?
That's what I'm hoping that we can get an idea of how much testimony they think they're going to need to provide. I wouldn't think it would be a whole lot of update, you know, and they could file simultaneously the first go around and then allow Superior an opportunity, or we could stagger it and then staff's expert could weigh in on whether or not, based on what they filed, he needs to file something. But I wouldn't think it would be a lot of testimony.
Would staff prefer that the commission not set a date certain for the hearing, or would that guidance be helpful?
I think we should set a date certain. And if those dates of the 13th through the 16th work, then I think we go for it.
Geez, my calendar is just free as all can be. So thank you for the guidance.
Any further questions? Karen, do you have anyone else from staff to testify?
No, I do not.
All right. Thank you. I don't know if I asked for a redirect or not, but is there anyone from Linda or Mark? Did you have anything to add at this time?
Yeah, this is Linda Walsh. I would like to add just a few things. I agree with Mr. Smith, and he correctly pointed out that the language quoted by Mr. Gerdes doesn't relate to the Section 210 discussion in the First v. Mississippi. And if you look at the quote that Superior has in its motion for reconsideration, that really shows the court's view on the Section 210 implementation process. And that is that the states had options to implement PURPA, and that and the South Dakota Commission, of course, chose the path of Order F3365, which was to undertake to resolve dispute. I also would like to point out that all of that took place more than two decades ago, and I think if the legislature, the South Dakota legislature, found something offensive there, they probably would have done something by now. So I would take the view that it's safe to say that the commission is well within its authority to act on not only its own orders, but Supreme Court orders as well. Whether there's any issues of fact here, I don't think there are. I think that's something that you can decide here without any hearing. But if the commission is inclined to find that the existing obligation question be that it's moved, and you're inclined to dismiss it on that ground, I think we would prefer that you defer decision on the motion. I think that it's certainly within the realm of possibility that MDU will file another petition at FERC, and that can happen at any time. So I don't see the motion as moot, and I don't see
us having to refile the motion. I think if anything, if we can hold it in abeyance, that piece of it. Of course, we'd prefer that the commission rule that there is an existing obligation and resolve that question once and for all. I think that would be the best way to proceed. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to ask that the commission go into executive session for 5 to 10 minutes. Is there a motion?
I move the commission go into a 5-minute executive session.
Second.
I will concur. Commission will come to order. On EL04-016, I move the commission grant Superior's motion to reconsider on the grounds that FERC has dismissed the QF purchase obligation suspension petition of Alliant Energy Corporate Services and that the commission has jurisdiction to hear and decide Superior's complaint. I further move that this matter be scheduled and noticed for hearing on December 13 through the 16th, 2005, and that the parties confer immediately following this hearing to resolve any pre-hearing scheduling issues.
Mr. Chairman, I'll second the motion.
And I concur.
On the second question, I move that the commission deny without prejudice Superior's request for a ruling on the issue of whether there is an existing obligation pending before the commission and that we rule on this issue in our final decision after hearing the evidence.
Second.
And I concur.
On the third question, I move that the commission deny Superior's request that the commission issue an order to show cause against MDU.
Second.
Concur.
That concludes the hearing on EL04-016. We have other issues before us, addendums to the agenda. One is on natural gas and one is on telecommunications. Does it matter which one we take first? I see that we're going to transcribe TC05-137. Is the... All right, we'll take the natural gas first. On the advice from counsel, that this will be short. NG05-013, in the matter of the filing by Montana Dakota Utilities Company, a division of MDU Resources Group, Incorporated, for approval of an amendment to a contract with deviation with Merillat Corporation. Today, shall the commission approve the amendment to the contract with less than 30 days' notice? And we'll hear from staff on this.
Thank
Mr. Jacobson.
Thank you, Chairman. MDU is on the line, but I can basically start the ball rolling here. This is merely an extension of a currently existing contract with Merillat for provision of gas service. The current contract would expire actually yesterday, and this is proposed to go into effect today for a one-year period, but no change in terms and conditions.
Thank you, Dave. Mr. Ball or anyone else with MDU, do you have comment?
Chairman, this is Tammy Eberly with MDU. As Dave said, this is a continuation of the existing agreement that we have with Merillat, who is a high load factor, large volume customer of ours. And this agreement would allow us to continue to serve them and to provide benefit to the other customers on the system by the fact that they are taking service under that agreement.
Thank you. Any questions by the commission? Is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I have moved that the commission approve the amendment to the contract with less than 30 days' notice.
Second.
And I concur. On the second addendum to the agenda, telecommunications TC05-137, in the matter of the joint petition for extension of suspension date and the date to file further suspension requests, the question before the commission is, shall the commission grant the motion to limit the scope of issues? Ms. Rogers?
afternoon again, members of the commission. My name is Darla Rogers, and I represent the joint petitioners in this case. The commission granted suspensions of LMP obligations, both intermodal and intramodal, to the petitioners and set deadlines by which the petitioners had to refile to extend the suspension or for the suspension to end. Subsequent to that, the Court of Appeals for the District of D.C. stayed enforcement of intermodal LMP for petitioners until the FCC acts on the final regulatory flexibility analysis. Within the six-month deadline imposed by this commission, the petitioners filed the current joint petition, and what we were asking you to do as a commission in that joint petition is to extend the suspension that you imposed, which will expire the end of December of 2005, until 6 months after the final decision by the FCC. Except for the case of ITC, the petitioners only have intermodal LMP requests. And even for ITC, this commission ordered interim LMP, which is provided, but they granted a suspension of long-term LMP. The petitioners are simply asking the commission to extend the deadlines already granted to recognize the federal court action. It's our position that it really makes no sense for the petitioners to spend the time and money and for this commission to also waste its resources on more LMP proceedings until the FCC acts and establishes the petitioners' intermodal LMP obligations. The truth of the matter is we do not know what the FCC is going to do and what they're going to rule in these cases. And so we're asking you to recognize that there is that federal action out there pending, and it could and probably most certainly will affect the final obligations of the petitioners. The intramodal LMP arguments that are raised by MIDCO and WWC are, in my opinion, red herrings. As I pointed out, no petitioner except ITC has a lawful request for intramodal LMP. Under the FCC's rules, even if such a request was received today, petitioners would not be required to provide intermodal LMP until 6 months after the request. So therefore, as a practical matter, an extension of the LMP suspension can have no impact on any potential wireline competitor. For ITC, the commission already heard the arguments about the merits of interim versus long-term LMP and the costs of providing long-term LMP. And based on that evidence, this commission ordered interim LMP, but granted a suspension of long-term LMP. The commission did not make a distinction in its orders between intramodal and intermodal long-term LMP, but rather granted a suspension of both. And the commission set the same deadlines by which ITC had to refile to extend the suspension or for the suspension to end. In light of the court's action, that is the federal district court, ITC also is seeking this commission to extend that deadline or the timeline to either request a further suspension or to provide long-term LMP. And that is in accordance with what this commission has already granted. The suspension's already granted. I want to take just a moment to comment to a couple of points raised by WWC in its opposition to this motion. First of all, I would like to clarify that the timing of the motion, and the motion here is to limit the scope of this proceeding to actually what we've asked for. And as I said, all we're asking is that you recognize the federal court action and how that could potentially affect our obligations and the time frames in which we would have to comply with those obligations. So the timing then of this current motion, and that is a motion to limit the scope, is not generated by a discovery deadline. We have said from the very beginning that our purpose in filing the joint petition was to ask the commission to recognize the federal action. We don't want to be caught in the middle and end up with some time schedule or compliance deadline with which it is impossible for us to comply.
In one portion of WWC's opposition, they admit that the petitioners may have an argument for a continuance of the intermodal LMP suspension until the FCC completes the RFA. We agree with that portion of WWC's opposition. We do think that we have a good argument, and that's why we brought it before you. I also need to clarify some of the statements in WWC's opposition concerning Swiftel, because they are factually incorrect. Swiftel's wireless company has implemented LMP, but it provides service through a separate switch, and Sprint provides all the LMP know-how referred to in WWC's opposition. Therefore, Swiftel's wireline employees are not trained in LMP, and they have no experience with LMP implementation. With regard to Midco's opposition, Midco argues that there are issues with interim LMP that the parties have been unable to find solutions for, and in fact, I think the petition or the opposition goes so far as to say that the parties are at loggerheads. I would disagree with that categorization. As an initial matter, Midco's comments are unsupported statements, and there is no evidence to support them. And we dispute, the ITC disputes those statements. ITC has tested interim LMP, the process, and it works. And we've worked with Midco to resolve certain issues like caller ID. We've tested the proposed solution, and it works. ITC is certainly available to discuss other alternative solutions or other alternative interim LMP methodologies and to try and resolve those issues. If, however, the Commission believes that these issues need to be examined factually, ITC would need a suspension or an extension of this existing suspension during that process. So I guess the bottom line for from the perspective of the joint petitioners is if the stay is lifted, we need a reasonable time to respond. We don't know what the FCC is going to do. Will they give us time to implement if that's what they order? If so, how much time? We don't want to be caught in a box of having the suspension here expire and then maybe a sudden and unexpected ruling from the FCC with regard to the stay. So that's our bottom line reason for bringing, first of all, the joint petition and then also the motion to limit the scope. The petitioners have already made the requisite showing under 47 U.S.C. Section 251F2. We wouldn't be here today but for the proceedings at the federal level, and so we're just asking this commission to recognize those federal actions and to extend our suspension accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Coit?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. This is Richard Coit, again representing SDTA. I would concur with Darla's comments, and I guess I agree with her that really the bottom line here is, you know, we as companies, those companies that have not implemented LMP, want to make sure that whatever the FCC decision is, there's a reasonable amount of time after that decision for them to take the action that they feel they need to take, and whether that be putting in another request to this commission for a continued suspension or actually implementing LMP. That's really what this is about. As far as the stay, currently there's a federal stay. And that's going to be in place until the FCC takes some other action. I have not heard anything as to when the FCC is expected to take that action. I'm not sure if anybody on the phone might have any input on that. We don't really know what's going to happen. And until we do, we just don't want to be caught in a bind without sufficient period of time. I suppose there could be some debate about, you know, the amount of time after the FCC makes a decision. Other than that, I agree that the issues in here should not extend to having to relitigate the actual suspension request. That doesn't seem to be the question here. So that's all I have, unless there are any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Coit. Mr. Wieczorek, are you still on the line with us? Tal?
Yes, I am.
Great.
The motion that's pending, they say it's to limit issues. And I'm not exactly sure what issues we're limiting here. What I hear them arguing, essentially, is we don't have an obligation to put on any evidence to establish this continuance. And quite frankly, I don't see how that can be legal determination. I think this commission to continue the stay that it granted, or the suspension, excuse me, that it granted, it has to take evidence. The evidence we discuss at that hearing is at least the information that they presented at the hearing is at least 18 months old. At least 18 months old. And during those 18 months, there's been substantial changes of these companies. Now, I see that there's this argument that the only reason they are here is because of the federal case. And I understand that the federal case on remand has essentially stayed intermodal LMP. And I'm going to reserve or restrict my comments to intermodal, as I believe that the federal court does not address intramodal at all. But in that, they are asking for not only that they don't have to provide local number portability while the FCC is completing its RFA analysis, they're asking for an automatic, for every ILEC in this petition, an automatic 6 months beyond that. And if I understand Ms. Rogers' comment, Ms. Rogers' comment is that they get the 6 months, and then even after the FCC would decide the RFA, we would have to make another bona fide request for them to provide local number portability, and they might get to be able to tack on from that request an additional 6 months. So they're asking for a substantial additional length of time, and I think the law is clear. They have to hold up some standard and put some evidence in to justify that additional length of time. Now, if they're comfortable with just relying on the stay, frankly, our position is the stay from federal court, if it goes longer than the end of this year, they're entitled to not – it's their option, frankly, under the district court or circuit court case as to whether they want to begin introducing intermodal LMP before the FCC finishes that analysis. But for them to get the additional 6 months beyond that, they have to show some evidence. And a good example of that is why the meeting was going on today. I got faxed to me from Ms. Rogers' office, supplemental filing by RC Communications on this notice matter. And RC Communications says in that supplemental notice that they've upgraded one of their switch, and now it has local number portability. Now, but they don't want to begin providing local number portability. They use the fact that their switches were not LMP compliant as ground to grant the suspension in the first place. They can't spend 18 months upgrading their systems, changing where they're at, and then come in here and say, look, we all need an additional 6 months. I use the Swisttail analogy. We argued that in the original hearing, and there was evidence on that. Well, Swisttail has some of this technology, already has some of this information. The other thing that was obvious, if we recall back to the original hearing, some of these companies are CLECs going into competitive markets where they have to provide portability. Now, what they've done to provide portability as CLECs, we should know, and that evidence should be put into place. This is not something where a blanket suspension should be granted. This should be granted on what they have available, the time will take them to get up to speed. The comparison they use is that 6 months is allowed under the FCC rules once you receive a bona fide offer. Essentially, they want to say, we get a start from scratch on this, even though Western Wireless requested local number portability 2 years ago from us. And I don't think the law supports that. I think they have to establish evidence for that additional 6 months.
the commission has to make findings to give them that additional 6 months. The the comments are such that, well, we don't know what we have to do. Well, this commission didn't do anything or allowed the status quo to remain static until the FCC decided every issue that might touch on the legal matters. This commission wouldn't ever do anything. I think it's safe to say that the FCC is not going to put these companies in any more or put these companies in any position that's going to be more demanding than the current laws that exist today. Even if the FCC decides something, the length of, they can't change the actual statutory law. They can't change the 47 U.S.C. 251F2 that sets forth the standard to meet to get the extension. The only thing they can change is maybe implementation date and how costs are going to be split out. But that's about it. I think we need to go back even what their submission was. They don't provide any legal authority that stands for the position that they don't have to put evidence on to get this additional extension. If the commission looks back through its original orders, it walks through the standards to meet to get this suspension. To say now that they can come in and because they got a suspension 18 months ago, they are automatically entitled to another suspension, not factually be supported and cannot legally be supported. That ought to take any questions the commission might have.
Thank you, Tal. Are there any questions at this time? If not, Mr. Gerdes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, my name is Dave Gerdes. I represent Mid-Continent Communications in this proceeding. As the Commission knows, as it relates to Mid-Continent, we're talking about intramodal LNP. The Commission specifically dealt with intramodal LNP in the prior docket when it said that with respect to providing interim intramodal number portability in Webster and Wabe exchanges to Mid-Continent, ITC has not met the public interest or the adverse economic criteria. The commission went on to rule that since we had a settlement agreement that we should go ahead and implement interim LNP. We have now found that there is no way to make interim LNP work so as the customer that is ported to Mid-Continent has caller ID. Now, caller ID is something, sort of a nice-to-have thing that people like to have, and it hampers the ability of Mid-Continent to secure customers because they're not going to want to come to Mid-Continent, those that are interested in LNP, or excuse me, interested in caller ID, they're not going to want to come to Mid-Continent because they can't keep it. And that's an inconvenience, and that is a good argument because it takes away a level playing field in competition. But more importantly than that, it also means that you cannot use 911 and emergency services because the as I understand it, when you're retaining the original, or you're retaining the wrong number in the database, and so when it comes up for a 911 call, they cannot get the correct address or identity of the person because it's coming from Mid-Continent switch, not the person's phone. And I'm probably, I see some puzzled looks. It's explained to me in any event that it also makes 911 services impossible to use. So there's also a public safety issue here. On September 30th, 2005, Mid-Continent personnel communicated this fact to ITC. That is that try as we might, this simply does not work. What we had tried to do was to do what was called a double call forwarding, which, and we are now told that's illegal. under the FCC rules. And that, quite frankly, was what we were thinking would make it work. But we are now told it's illegal. And we told them back on September 30th that this is the problem and we need to do something about it. We haven't heard anything back since then, to my knowledge, in response to that, that inquiry. Now, I'm not sure what the motion to limit the issues means as to intramodal LNP. That's part of our problem. If, in fact, it is the intention of ITC that somehow we should continue with this interim LNP in the way that we are now using it, it's totally unacceptable to Mid-Continent. Back when we settled this thing, we were told interim number portability would work. It simply has not worked. I don't think there was any mean spirit or misleading by anybody in the settlement negotiations. I think we all thought it would work, but it's not working. The fact that it's not working has to be recognized, and we have to be able to go forward. There has never been an order that has suspended LNP that I'm aware of, LNP as it relates to intermodal LNP. We've been talking about intramodal. Excuse me, I got confused. Other way around. There's never been an order that relates to intramodal LNP. It all relates to intermodal LNP. So, quite frankly, what Mid-Continent needs is what the law provides, nothing more. And so we need to make sure that we are able to distinguish in this proceeding that we have right now between intramodal LNP and intermodal LNP and get this problem resolved. Mid-Continent right now has an application to go into Santel's area as well. And so this is going to continue to be an issue until it can be worked out to the satisfaction of all. And again, we don't want to get lost in the shuffle here. There's a big fight here between the wireless company WWC and Western Wireless and these phone companies. And that's fine, well, and good, and they need to get that resolved. But in the process, we were also in the original docket, and we were dealt with. And we want to make sure that we are entitled to be heard in this docket and to find some solution to the problem that we now have. And that's why I'm here. I'm not sure what this motion to limit the issues means, but if it means that we would be treated in such a fashion that we cannot obtain redress, then we would object.
Thank you, Mr. Gertis. Ms. Wiest?
Thank you. This is for Elaine Wiest. I'm going back to their joint their motion. The petitioners are asking the commission to rule that the proceeding is limited to the question presented by the petitioners, namely whether the commission should extend the deadlines in the LNP orders in light of the federal court and the FCC. And what I think the commission could do is I think that the commission could actually grant this motion to limit to the extent that any evidentiary hearing that is needed would not be about whether they need to meet, whether they have to show that they meet the federal requirements, the 251F2 requirements. But I am very sympathetic to Mr. Gertis's argument, and what I would just point out to everybody is what I think is a very possible scenario in this is that the commission could have some sort of evidentiary hearing, and it could be about, as Mr. Wazorik's one of the main issues he argued, how long after should any such further suspension, do they really need 6 months, and do all of them really need 6 months? But I think a possible scenario is that since they're basing it on the light of the actions of the federal court and the FCC, which only relate to intermodal, is that the commission could very well find that they will grant the extension for intermodal and not grant the extension for intramodal, which I think what would happen then is that at the end of December, unless you get some sort of temporary suspension in there, is that at that moment, ITC is then under the obligation to provide intramodal LNP to Mid-Continent at that point. If if they want to limit the issues, and so we're not looking at whether they have to meet any of the requirements, I think that would be the outcome of this. And I would also note that it was the staff's position way back in this case that ITC shouldn't be granted a suspension, and the reason they shouldn't be granted, one of the reasons that they shouldn't be granted suspension is due to the fact that Mid-Continent was requesting intramodal LNP. So maybe I'm repeating myself, but to the extent that the commission would grant the motion to limit the issues, I think that is fine. But I just think that the petitioner should be aware that one of the very real outcomes is that they will be, at least for ITC, may be providing LNP at the end of December, or if you grant temporary suspension, whenever that ends. But at least the evidentiary hearing wouldn't be all about, do they meet those requirements? Do they have to show that they meet all those requirements? Because I don't have a lot of sympathy with the intermodal because, I mean, a stay is a stay. They just don't have to do it right now.
Thank you. Are there questions by the commission at this time?
I just want to make sure that I got Ms. Weiss's point right. Staff would be in favor of essentially bifurcating the issue and granting the limit to the motion to limit on the intermodal side.
I actually, and I'm just thinking this through the way when we were up here at the meeting, but I don't know that there's any harm in granting the motion to limit for both intermodal and intramodal. My point is that the petitioners have not asked to put in evidence to show that they should be granted any extension with respect to intramodal. They only want an extension. They want you to look at an extension only in light of the federal courts and the FCC. Well, if you're only looking at it in the light of what the federal courts and the FCC did, then it's staff's belief that you may well decide that fine intermodal is not going to be implemented at the end of this year, but that had no effect on intramodal, and they have not, as the order, your order already said they didn't make that showing with respect to ITC. But the order also said that intermodal and intramodal was suspended, that you did suspend both. So I think a likely outcome in staff's mind is that intramodal LNP would have to be implemented at the end of December. And maybe I'm missing something, but those are just my thoughts.
Mr. Smith, go ahead.
A follow-up question. I mean, because this issue is evolving as it is, and they did meet the commission's directive procedurally to file on or before whatever the day was, and I forgot. Mm-hmm. If the commission were to grant the intermodal part and deny the intramodal part, would it be appropriate for the commission to entertain a motion from ITC or whomever the intramodal portion related to permit an amendment of the complaint to expand it to encompass the additional factual elements of a suspension?
I guess I would have to, I'd wait until they actually wanted to make that point. My point is that what they've done here is they've made a motion to limit it, and they want it limited to the federal action. And if that's their petition, and I know you asked for the petition prior to a certain date. Well, this is their petition. Their petition is that you should extend the deadline because of the actions of the federal court and the FCC. That's what they asked for.
And Dusty, you were done?
Yes.
Bob? And I'll look to both Mr. Gertis and Rolaine for the answer to this one, and certainly give Ms. Rogers an opportunity to correct me if I'm wrong. But with the intramodal, my recollection is part of the reason that we granted the forbearance, so to speak, on that was that you thought you had a technical fix with that double call forwarding. And since it appears now that that's not working, I mean, do you know, Ms. Rogers, is what Mr. Gertis said correct from your client's standpoint?
It's an email to you.
May I answer that? Mary Sipsack?
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
From ITC's standpoint, that is not correct. And you know, it's kind of hard to respond to what I will term allegations. Frankly, our position is that Mr. Gerdes and Mid-Continent are simply wrong. There is no FCC rule that prohibits double remote call forwarding. There is no industry rule that prohibits it. There is an industry practice that establishes the way, the preferred way for certain things to be done, but it does not preclude carriers from doing things in a different way. And from a technical perspective, caller ID will work, 911 will work. They had another issue about cab billing, which would be Mid-Continent getting certain compensation. That was worked out. So in ITC's position, all the outstanding issues even raised by Mid-Continent have been worked out. But frankly, most of the issues really don't have anything to do with whether technically interim LNP can work. These were just some kind of fine-tuning issues that Mid-Continent requested that we investigate. We investigated. We came up with a fix. Now, we obviously have a difference of opinion because Mid-Continent is here today saying the fix doesn't work. And if they want to present a factual case showing why they think the fix doesn't work, we can respond to it. But it's hard to just respond to basically an assertion made by Mr. Gerdes.
Well, may I respond?
Yes, please do.
Please. This isn't an assertion made by Mr. Gerdes. This is an email that was sent to Darla Rogers on the 30th of September, to which we have not received a response.
Well, I think Ms. Lone's in the room. If she'd like to testify to her email and what she thinks it really means, I suppose the commission could have her do so, but my reading of Ms. Lone's email does not support your position either, Mr. Gerdes. Again, that, I guess, is ultimately a factual question.
Then, Ms. Weiss, just to jog my memory, the differences on the intramodal versus intermodal, how the obligations differ when you're looking at LNP in those two situations?
I mean, they still have to, to get a suspension, they need to meet the same requirements, the 251 requirements.
And with the filing that's been put forth right now, has there been, what I'm trying to grasp at is with the intramodal, right now with the petitioner's filing, is, in your mind, is there enough to grant the motion to limit the scope of the issues as to intramodal?
See, I think that you could grant the motion for both intermodal and intramodal. The question is, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have any type of evidentiary hearing. I think the motion to limit, and Ms. Rogers can correct me, but what the motion to limit would most likely do is that it would not require the petitioners to try to prove up the 251 requirements at the evidentiary hearing. And with respect to intermodal, I would think one of the main issues would be, okay, fine, there's a stay. How long after the stay do they really need in order to, you know, either implement it or ask for another suspension?
Thank you.
Mr. Coit, did you have something to add?
Thank you. I would like to respond, Mr. Saar, your question with regard to what's different about inter versus intra. And I think we can't forget that transport issue. If you recall the hearing, there was an awful lot of time spent on the transport issue. And at the FCC proceeding in the RFA analysis, much of the analysis that I believe the FCC is doing and probably the most difficult part of their decision has to do with which carrier has the responsibility for transport in an LNP situation. Right now the way the FCC had implemented intermodal before, there was not a specific requirement that there be a direct connection by the wireless company within that local calling area, which has led to a lot of issues over okay, if you're not going to have a direct connect necessarily going to that particular area, who's responsible for what in terms of how do you get the calls to the wireless customer from a landline customer and vice versa? So those are really the more difficult issues that I think the FCC is faced with. And, you know, looking at it from a LEC perspective, I would just ask the question of Mr. Wieczorek, what does he want from the LECs? Is it reasonable to expect that a LEC might have to, you know, the FCC, and maybe the FCC will address the issue of how much time we all have. But is it reasonable if the FCC tomorrow comes out with a decision and says that the stay is over and you have to implement LMP within 2 weeks, is it reasonable to expect that ELEC would be in a position to do that within that short of period of time? I do think that, you know, there may be, if you're going to look at any questions, I think Ms. Weiss says it correct. It's a question of how much time, you know, how much time is necessary for implementation. And that may vary from company to company. But that's not the same as undertaking a complete analysis of all of the cost of implementing LMP, which is what we did the first go-around. It's not the same as looking at the public interest with respect to LMP. So I think, you know, that's the focus of the motion. It's, if you're going to limit it, you're going to limit it to stuff that's relative to, okay, how much time after the stay expires, you know, how much time should companies be given? And it may all be rendered moot because maybe the FCC will say, we're going to lift the stay, but we're going to lift it 9 months from now. We're going to lift it 6 months from now. So, but now we don't know that, and it doesn't seem reasonable to me to say that we don't have to address it because, you know, that they can implement it, you know, with a snap of a finger. It's just not that way.
Do you know if there's any negotiations going on to solve some of the disputes over LMP? Because my recollection is that hearing and right thereafter, a few of the disputes got resolved. One of the things that we talked about when we ruled on it was hope that there'd be ongoing negotiations among all the groups to try to figure out ways to move towards it. Certainly mindful that in some cases the cost factor is just prohibitive.
I think, you know, there's certainly been, I know, discussions within the LEC organization about, among the LECs about, okay, how do we address the transport issue where there's not a direct connect. But what's happened in that case, in that situation, is, again, one of the large issues that the FCC is faced with, not just in the LMP case, but in the intercarrier compensation proceedings, is transport obligations. So what's happened is the rural LECs have taken their position with respect to, you know, transport obligations in the intercarrier comp proceedings. And those positions are pretty firm and solid right now. And you've got the other position that the wireless carriers and other carriers that don't want to pay for as much transport as they may be paying for today, you know, they're taking a position that is kind of opposite of that. And so you've got, you know, two groups that don't agree on the transport, and really that has stood in the way of carriers getting anything done on transport because they're all sitting around waiting to see, okay, what's the FCC going to require us to do? Who's going to have responsibility for what? I look at the intercarrier comp proceedings, there are really two big issues, and that is, you know, will there be an access fee of some sort, and who has the responsibility to transport traffic to where? And until those two obligations are addressed, not much is happening. So I think the FCC is going to have to look at those, and it all relates to LMP, and that's why, you know, that's why we look at it and say, how can you expect us to do this stuff tomorrow? We don't know what the obligation is going to be yet.
Well, and thank you, and I appreciate your comments about the intramodal, and I was just trying to recall back to where, and I don't have a follow-up question, just a comment to make, but I was just trying to recall back to some of the discussions there because obviously you have some different dynamics dealing with intramodal, and certainly from a competition standpoint, I think there's some, you know, pretty compelling arguments that can be made on the intramodal side towards, you know, favoring going to LNP that maybe don't necessarily hold completely true on
the wireless side, but I appreciate you pointing out that the transport can still be an issue and some of the other points. And I also wanted to know that I certainly wasn't saying that those weren't significant, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree the issues are significantly different.
Just 1 minute. Ordinarily, we don't have folks who are testifying ask questions of other folks that are testifying, but I know Tal might be interested in answering your question.
Mr. Chairman, do you want me to be sworn in before I respond? I would like to address a couple of things. First, Ms. Weiss' position. The ILEC, in our opinion, WWC in mind, they have essentially a stay under the federal court action until the RFA is completed and published as required under that court case. Now, I have actually learned more from what potentially this motion means from what the comments Mr. Coit just said than I have from anything up till now or the filing. It appears to me, and there is no way under the law that they can argue for an additional 6 months without some kind of evidentiary hearing. I want to hear Mr. Coit saying, which I wasn't clear on before, is that they acknowledge they have to put on some factual evidence, though their position is it might not have to be as much to get the initial suspension. However, I think it puts the commission in a situation, given that there's been no real definition of how they're going to present it or what they think they need to put on for this commission to make a determination of exactly how you narrow these issues, and that causes me some concern. You know, Frank, it's likely their issue, meaning the ILEC's issue, because if they don't put on sufficient evidence, there may be a legal challenge as to whether they are entitled to the additional 6 months. Given given Mr. Coit's question, I'm not the one, or WWC is not the one, that asked for a blanket suspension for every company. You look back to, and I know the commission didn't accept the staff's determination, but if you look back to staff, what they determined on the first go-around, more than a year ago, they thought some of these companies could start providing local number portability essentially by the time the appeal time had run on any order this commission would have entered, 30 to 60 days. Those companies have done nothing. Even if they stood still, they're still in that situation. And more than likely, most of them have done some upgrades that are going to make local number portability easier to do. So I think there has to be an evidentiary hearing on that. There might be some practical short time period in which to begin to provide local number portability. Do I think the appropriate time period is 6 months, which is the time period the FCC gives companies that start from scratch? No. Certainly not for all these companies. Certainly some of these companies are made a lot of progression and are ready to just flip the switch to add the software is already on the switch and all they have to do is pay for it to get it implemented. And I wanted to address the transporting issue. Now, I understand that that's a big issue for the ILEC. It was a big issue and it was litigated in the underlying hearing. In that situation, when they did their cost analysis, the ILEC assumed, worst-case scenario, they'd have to pay all that transportation. And even then, the cost for some of these companies was minor per month for subscribers. So I think there's been nothing but cost going down on these. And I think there has to be some evidentiary showing for them to be entitled to anything beyond a stay period. I think that I was trying to take notes, and Mr. Coit was asking his question, and I think that covers it. But if not, I'll take a follow-up.
Thank you very much, Tal. Are there any further questions by the commissioners? John?
I have a question maybe for Ms. Rogers or Mr. Coit with respect to the procedural issue raised by Ms. Weiss. If the commission were to grant your motion and we limit the scope of the evidentiary proceeding as it stands now for both intermodal and intramodal, to just the stay, the effect of the order, and the other two things you asked for were the two time limit rulings. What then happens with respect to the intramural proceeding? I mean, would it be your feeling that if we were to grant that and that's the effect of it, are you going to want to come in and move to amend your pleading with respect to ITC at least or any other?
Mr. Smith, may I answer that question? This is Mary Sisak.
Mm-hmm.
I want to begin by simply saying that the purpose of the original filing and frankly the purpose of the motion that's before the commission today, when the commission granted the original suspensions, they gave all the petitioners the opportunity to come back into the commission and to basically put on another whole case to demonstrate that a suspension should be extended beyond December 31st, or if they didn't make that showing, then to be capable of providing LNP by December 31st. When we had the intervening court action, basically telling all the petitioners that they did not have to provide intermodal LNP, and for almost all the petitioners except ITC, that's the only kind of request that they face. We looked at that and we said, well, we have no idea when the FCC is going to act, but we know that if we want an extension beyond December 31 from the South Dakota Commission, we have to start preparing cost studies and we have to start preparing a case to be filed before the South Dakota Commission by October. We didn't think that made any sense. We thought that it didn't make sense for the petitioners or for the commission to go through another two-week hearing starting in October when we had this whole court FCC issue out there, which effectively meant that most of the petitioners had no obligation to implement LNP. And that was the whole purpose of our filing. So to get back to your specific question, we think that the commission original order, which gave the petitioners the opportunity to come back in and make a new 251F showing, we think the commission should still do that. And so if you don't grant our motion and you don't grant our petition ultimately, some of these petitioners are still going to want the opportunity to be able to do the cost studies, get the consultants all lined up, and come back in and make another 251F showing. And part of our problem with the way that the process has gone is, and I think Ms. Weiss' comments demonstrate that our concern was not unjustified. We filed this original petition and included that October filing deadline as something we wanted the commission to tell us, do we still have to meet that October deadline to make a full-fledged cost showing, or are we all going to recognize that there's this federal court action out there which just makes that timeline not very practical anymore, the original timeline put in place by the commission?
Thank you. I mean, I guess just gut feeling-wise, my feeling is you met the deadline by making your filing for an additional suspension in terms of the deadline. I think what I'm getting at is just, you know, what I'm trying to get at is, do we have some kind of weird Donnybrook here, or is this something that can, if there is an issue, can it be easily corrected with a simple procedural motion? And that would be if we grant the petition, and that, I think Ms. Wiest is correct, that's your petition is couched in terms of the intermodal order and the stay that emanates from that, which does not apply to intramodal porting. Is this something that could easily be fixed by moving the commission to permit an amendment of your petition, at least with respect to those companies that are impacted currently by the fact that the state does not apply to intramodal porting?
I'm trying to get at,
is this a problem that we can easily solve? It's not some intractable...
I think it's a problem that can be easily solved. If I understand your question... And tell me if I'm wrong, but your possibly saying that ITC, for example, would file something else requesting some time to put together a case to continue the suspension on intramodal LNP? Is that what you're suggesting?
That's exactly what I'm suggesting.
Then, yes, that could be done.
Thank you.
I concur with that, and I also wanted to note one other thing, and I had it in my notes and forgot to footnote it. That's what I get for making notes, I guess. I did neglect to mention that we did, in fact, file a supplemental petition on behalf of RC Communications. It was drawn to our attention after we filed our original petition that shortly after that, RC did upgrade their switch in the Summit Exchange and have taken steps to implement LMP. But again, I think that this is an example maybe of Rolaine's point then that, you know, maybe the issues that we want to try to limit here is the timing issue. Obviously, RC still has the transiting issue because they don't have any intramodal requests. They're the only carrier in Summit, so there isn't any other landline carrier or wireline carrier. So we're not dealing with intramodal in that case, but in our supplemental petition, they're requesting the commission to extend their obligation or to extend the suspension with regard to intermodal because it's not just the switch upgrade, but there are other issues out there that are unresolved. And in their situation, they've asked the commission to extend that for 120 days just because, you know, they have taken some steps. So I think we just need I think that we need to have a specific handle on what the issues are in this case, and that was the reason we brought the motion to limit it to the extent that we need to amend our motion to provide some additional factual determinations in the case of ITC, then we would like the opportunity to do so.
Thank you. Are there any further questions by commission? Is there anyone who is compelled to provide us any new information? If not, I will move the commission take a 10-minute executive session.
Second.
I concur.
We'll come back to order. We have a motion. I move that the commission grant petitioner's motion to limit the scope of issues to the issues raised by the joint petition, namely whether the existing suspensions should be extended based upon the pendency of the FCC's proceeding in CC docket number 95-116, and if so, what the length of the new suspension should be.
Second.
I concur.
Thank you. That ends the hearing on TC 05-137. Announcements. Remind you that we have an executive director position that is open, and we wish Pam the very best. The next regularly scheduled commission meeting will be held December 6, 2005 at 9:30 a.m. in room 468 here in Pierre. Commission meetings are also scheduled for December 20 and January 17th. Commissioners, a hearing in docket TC 05-137 will be held December 6th through 8th, and a hearing on docket EL 04-106 will be held December 13th through the 16th. Both of those in room, first one is in room 468, the second one in room 412. Both of them here in Pierre. And we appreciate all of you who have participated and listened in on the web, and that concludes the hearing.